Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Representing for a second time, Whip Snakes Lacrosse Club!
Oh! Chase, was that you?
Oh, no.
Uh-oh.
Did you break the trophy?
No.
Yeah, it was, that was pretty crazy.
Scores! What? What?
You got to get the ball to 42.
Run lacrosse!
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast. We have reached the postseason. Alongside Chris Rosenthal, I am Kevin Brown. Rosie, we've made it through up and down 10 weeks of the regular season, plus the All-Star break, of course. And we've got a special episode for you listeners. No guest, some unadulterated takes from yours truly's. And Rosie, we've got superlatives on the way. We've got some end of season awards takes to give out. And of course, naturally, we're going to preview more in depth than we did last week. The two quarterfinal games. No, there are not four quarterfinal games. There are two games, as there are two teams waiting for their opponents on the other side of the bye for the semifinals on Long Island. Rosie, how we doing?
I want to say we're doing okay. Mixed emotions, because this is the best and worst part of the season to me. You know, obviously it's great because we're marching towards that championship. You want to see who's going to be celebrating out in Chester, Pennsylvania. But also it's the worst because, you know, these are the last times we're going to see these teams. They're going to lose and they're out. And then you never know. Some people are going to leave and not come back. Some people are going to get, you know, find other teams via free agency. So everything changes as well. So yeah, emotional roller coaster right now.
Yep. The first off-season retirement has come, and shout out Jake Caraway on a fantastic career, the all-time points and goals leader for Georgetown Hoyas, and played a, few seasons in the PLL with Atlas and the Water Dogs. Like you said, we're going to see some guys leave this off season that maybe were not expected. It was kind of unexpected to see Jake leave this early, but I know he had a great career and wish him all the best. But before we get to those quarterfinal previews, Rosie, we've got some end of season award takes to give out, as mentioned. Let's start with the positional awards, and then we'll get to the money makers with the coach of the year, rookie of the year, MVP down the line. But let's give the fans what they want. Let's start with offense and the attackman of the year. Rosie, you want to read off the nominees? You want me to read the nominees, and then you can give the takes? What format are we doing here? Behind the scenes, live for the listeners.
Let's switch off the nominee reading per position or category. So I will kick things off reading off these attackmen. You have Jeff Teat, Zed Williams, Marcus Holman, Asher Nolting, and Michael Sowers. What do you think? Well, look, let's not dance around this too much. I think the clear front runner here is, you know, no need to waste the good people's time. Clear front runner here would have to be one Jeff Teat. In your opinion, do you? Oh, yeah, yeah. Quick disclaimer for the listeners. We do both have ballots. That is correct, right? You have a ballot as well, right, Kevin?
Yep, we both have ballots. That is correct.
Yes. We do have ballots. That being said, we are not allowed to literally share who we have picked, even if we have or have not placed our ballots in the mail yet. We're not allowed to tell you, but we can certainly tell you front runners and, you know, certain candidates who may have advantages over others, inside tracks, if you will. And I think this is a good time to go ahead and... Absolutely. Front runner, inside track for this one. It's fairly easy to say that's going to be a Jeff Teat award. He has been the best player, the most prolific scorer and he happens to be an attackman, so why would he not win attackman of the
year? Yeah, my eyes, the Ian McNaney and Jim Brown awards both wrapped up, right? The bigger discussion is who would you have second? And in my eyes, it's kind of a snub not to put TJ Malone in this conversation. You read online, see my PLL rookie power rankings, and I'm really not hiding it. You mentioned we can't outright disclose who we're voting for, but if you read in between the lines, the very clear lines, you can tell my affinity for Mr. Malone. Just listen to last podcast. He's a great guy. He's always happy. The nicest assassin you'll ever meet, as the ESPN broadcast brought up in their regular season finale against the Outlaws. He finished third among all players, but of course attackmen are going to finish the season with the most points, tied with Michael Sowers. So if you're tying Michael Sowers right out of the gates in your pro debut season, that's impressive stuff. Zed Williams got the nod instead, and there was some murmur, some talk of his MVP rise the second half of the season. I would much rather see Malone in that role. And it's much the same for my kind of college All-American voting. I like the quarterback attackman a little more than the finishers, and which is why I would go with Asher Nolting finishing second here and over his teammate Marcus Allman.
Well, first and foremost, shout out for you playing the game properly and adding one person but taking one person off. Everybody knows that is the rule. Yeah, and first and foremost, Malone, I agree. I was surprised to not see his name mentioned on that list when the nominees came out. Yeah, virtually identical numbers to Michael Sowers, you know, just with more ground balls and caused turnovers, you know, and fewer touches. So, you know, what he has done in that offense has been really remarkable. And, you know, I do not think he got the recognition he deserves when it comes to this particular category. But yeah, you know, we saw Nolting, and I feel like I don't know what it's going to take for him to really break over everyone else. You know, I hope he doesn't have one of those careers where it's just always him finishing right below somebody else. But that being, you know what I mean? Like, if he's going to be like a like in an old school basketball terminology, like a Barkley or a Karl Malone or somebody like that, with Michael Jordan constantly winning everything above him. But yeah, he's put together a fantastic year. I guess the only thing you would tax him on is the turnover number, leading the league in it. But he does have the big task of being the quarterback in that sort of offense. So, you know, you're going to count on him to make some mistakes. It's kind of baked in, along with all the success he demonstrates.
Now let's move on to the next positional group, the midfielder of the year. We've got Tom Schreiber, whose season is very unfortunately finished with that pretty tough injury in their penultimate game for their homecoming. Matt Campbell, who led the league in two-pointers most of the season and was caught up to the last several games before moving to attack, much to Paul Carcaterra's dismay in that the last couple games. Zach Currier, and another season of just all around stats for him. Just love those tweets whenever they surface of more ground balls than this faceoff guy, more calls turnovers than this defenseman, more points than this attackman. He does it again. Docs Aiken, what a resurgent year for him, coming back from football pursuit last year. And Grant Amon has the chance to make history as the first attackman of the year and the first midfielder of the year. Rosie, what do you How do you size up these finalists?
So you have yourself Ament and Schreiber as the top scorers. Schreiber just a little bit behind Ament, but you know, like you said, he missed that one game. Ament finished the year with 28 points and Schreiber with 27. So, you know, who knows if Ament would have held on to that title. That being said, what Zach Currier does, I think it's difficult, as I'm not going to say it's underrated, because I think it would be silly to say that Zach Currier is underrated.
I would kick you off the pod if you said it.
Right. Yeah. Also, I never call anything underrated because I am presently rating things. So why would I ever call something underrated? I am the one rating. But I do say it is difficult sometimes to properly synthesize exactly how many different things he is bringing to the table. And so if you're going to, say, compare him to your Schreiber, to the other candidates here, it's going to be impossible to do. You can't just say the numbers. I think the fact that he is so tremendously well-rounded is something, while it's not part of the job criteria, right? This isn't, you know, an old school game where you have to have your Max Seabolds running up and down the field, right? You don't have to be an old Kyle Harrison or whatever the way is, the two-way middies. We don't have those in bunches. But, you know, this is somebody who's putting up 19 points, causing 13 turnovers, scooping 34 ground balls. And this season in particular, you have to remember he was effectively wasted at the beginning of the year. Because, you know, through no fault of his own, but he's the face-off guy in a league that actually had face-off specialists everywhere else. So I have to imagine his numbers would have been tremendously inflated compared to what we got if he was actually just worried about playing midfield or playing those wings and not worrying about facing off all those times to start the season. So is he the front runner? I don't know. He's won one, I believe. But I certainly think he's always due to win it. So, you know, we'll see how the voters go on it. But a performance like that always catches my eye because of how unique it really is.
Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb and say no Philadelphia Water Dogs will win end of season awards this campaign because of their unfortunate 2-8 regular season outing. So I do think it is between Tom Schreiber and Grant Ament, and I do like the storyline of winning at both positions is pretty incredible career arc. So that's where I'll leave it. But let's go down to the other end of the field here, the Defensive Player of the Year, or the Dave Petromala Defensive Player of the Year. Rosie, your turn for the nominees.
Yes, sir. And the nominees are Gavin Adler, Garrett Eppel, Matt Dunn, and JT Giles Harris. What do you think?
Now, this is tough. This is a really interesting race, I think, between Gavin Adler and JT Giles Harris. But you cannot ignore the fact that the reigning Defensive Player of the Year upped his cause turnover stat by 2 or 3, right? Garrett Eppel up to 20 cause turnovers this year, up from 17 or 18 last year, so you got to throw him in the ring, of course, but I just like Gavin Adler's body of work and the fact that he got the podcast bump, of course, and JT Giles Harris being on a less dominant team is kind of how I would present the hierarchy of those nominees.
Yeah, this is a really, really interesting one to me. I'm not really sure what the voters are going to look for, like what's really going to catch their eye. Certainly the easiest thing to do is go for the cause turnovers. And, you know, also I think there are some people who probably give an inside bump because Apple won it last year as well. So, you know, is a bit of a reigning title holder. You know, maybe they feel like they kind of have to get bumped off of their throne in this case, and someone who leads the league once again in cause turnovers might just deserve the crown again. I would not be mad about JT Giles-Harris. I thought Gavin Adler, esteemed friend of the pod, had an outstanding season. You know, just the difference between him this year and last when he comes back healthy was tremendous. And we saw kind of his defensive flexibility as far as matchups go. And I would say the same thing about Matt Dunn. You know, we really saw sort of a bounce back season for him. Same sort of situation, getting healthy and getting his game back up to the level that he had been used to in prior seasons. And again, sort of a similar situation to Adler, being able to match up in different situations. I have legitimately no idea who is going to win this, and I would not be surprised if any of them did, not knowing anything about who the rest of our voting peers are. So I'm not going to even pick one. Man, I don't know. I really have no idea where this goes. Maybe Gavin Adler takes it. He's had a very solid year, put a lot on tape, and his cause turnovers are right there. He's got 19, so you know he's pretty much right there with Garrett Eppel in that front.
Yeah, you're spot on with all of that, especially the fact that I do think I overlooked Matt Dunn in my little spiel there. I caught some flack mid-season when I put together my mid-season team of the year kind of article together. Like, well, where's the chaos love for the best defense in the league? There's no chaos representatives for the Defensive Player of the Year award. And my take on that, Rosie, I think they eat votes slash whatever you want to call it from each other, right? Like Jared Newman, Jack Rowlett, Will Bowen rotated with Jack Posey a little bit, so they're kind of both out of it. So it's mainly between Newman and Rowlett. And both those guys are elite. We know this. So Rowlett matching up with those speedy guys and also has the versatility to match up with physical guys, and Newman and Asher is going to be we'll get to that in a little bit when we preview the quarterfinals. So just wanted to throw that out there that the chaos, we're not forgetting about you. Just I do think your defense as a whole is so good and you make up for such a lousy offense that it's tough to pick one representative for the defense player of the year.
I thought Jack Rowlett was, well, I can't say whether or not I voted for him, but I will say that I thought he was perhaps the best, we'll say maybe the best, defensive player of last year. So he and his teammates are recognized for their abilities, even if they're not on the list this year.
Yes, continued excellence for sure. And I think a lot of the reason, too, is as we go down the list to the goalie of the year, a lot of guys just say Blaze Bale. I don't think everyone says Blaze bails them out, but having a goalie of Blaze's caliber anchoring that defense is just a whole difference maker, right? He led the league in save percentage once again, fighting through all these injuries. He had the magnificent goalie goal, of course, that we all loved. And let's read out the rest of the nominees here for the Goalie of the Year End of Season Award. Blaze Reardon won, just mentioned Colin Kearse for the Cannons. Nice to see him get back-to-back nods for finalists. Brett Dobson coming off the championship MVP. And rookie Liam Entman, one of the only rookies for these end-of-season positional awards, joining a teammate that we'll get to. Rosie, is it fair to say it's Blaze's to lose?
I would say absolutely. It is Blaze's to lose, as it has been throughout much of the existence of the PLL. And you know, I guess you would say, if you're arguing on behalf of Dobson, the number one thing is his save total is much higher. He led the league in his saves, 147. I think 18 more than Colin Kurst, but I really just think, yeah, it's the inside track kind of belongs to Blaze Reardon in this category. And, you know, despite missing some time this year, I think unless he dramatically falls off, it's just going to be his. I just think he's so consistently excellent when he is playing that there's not enough on paper against him or in the eye test, certainly not the eye test, to really say this is not his year. You know, he had the highest save percent in the league. And notably for him, granted, like I said, he missed a little bit of time there, but never finished below 50%. But whereas everybody else did, you know, Entman did once, Dobson did three times, Kurst did twice. So, you know, again, you didn't have him for every second of every game, but when he was in there, he was still performing at an elite level. Certainly not one that I think would fall off to the degree where you think, well, now's the time to kind of, you know, take the belt out of his hands on this one.
Yeah, moving right along, I think you can say the same for the faceoff end of season award finalist when it comes to Trevor Baptiste, except when it comes to 2024. If there was a comeback player of the year award, it would go to this player. And funny enough, he also leads all faceoff guys in faceoff percentage. That's Joe Nardella I'm talking about. Stay tuned. We're recording this on Wednesday night. I'm not too sure when the podcast will be released, but stay tuned for a nice little feature from IL on Nardella's journey back. But finishing the year off with 67.5%, he's joined with fellow faceoff elite players, two guys that were on the Team USA roster that, Rosie, you'll remember that Nards, he was trying out for that spot, kind of fighting with TD to get it in training camp, for Team USA tryouts, rather, and then that's when the ACL tear happened. Had to miss all of last season, back this season with vengeance, back with motivation, and it's really shown with Baptiste and TD Erlin, those two other finalists. I think really just the stats don't lie when it comes to faceoff. So
yes, I agree generally, but the stats do lie a little bit with his faceoff percentage because he got to go against the Water Dogs before they had a faceoff guy in there.
Very true.
So he went 31 for 31. So that got to inflate his to a degree that some of the others didn't benefit. But that being said, even if you took that game out, he has been consistently dominant all year. Similar to Blaze, never finishing below 50%, which is something that his, you know, his peers, you can't say that about. You know, Baptiste had some kind of uncharacteristic games during the season, and TD Erlin was pretty much neck and neck with Nardella throughout the season, and they basically split their head-to-head matchup. But Erlin had bad matchups against Sisselberger the two times he faced him. So I think unless there is a really strong desire to, you know, keep the belt with Baptiste, or, you know, if there's too much discounting from that one Water Dogs game or something like that, then, you know, maybe some people go in another direction. But I do think Nardella is the front runner, and rightfully so. And they should give him a comeback player of the year award. They should just make one up this year.
Much better breakdown that I provided. So thank you, Rosie, for that. This award is probably the closest contested, I would say. The first year post Michael Earhart. And will they rename it to the Michael Earhart Award? Wins it every single year he was in the league. The LSM of the Year Award we're referring to. Rosie, tell us the nominees.
Oh, boy, your nominees for the LSM of the year are Carpenter, Connors, and Raw. I can say that real quick to keep things moving.
It's funny because Carpenter,
there you go,
he's got a much better chance at the positional award than the Rookie of the Year award, in my opinion. So I think you'd have to consider his couple two-pointers, his otherworldly ground ball total. I think it was 40 or something coming off those wings. Jared Connors provided a spark for the Redwoods, but not enough team success. Nathan Rahl, I think, is right up there with Carpenter.
Yeah, I think, like what you said about the Water Dogs not really being eligible for things could certainly kind of affect Redwoods as well. And, you know, voters are kind of inclined to stick with the guys who are still playing at this point in the season. Rahl had a year that, you know, I think his coach said it best, and I might have repeated it earlier in the podcast, weeks ago. Not the big numbers early on in the year, fundamentally solid defense, but nothing really eye-catching or, not a lot to submit as far as resumes go for this kind of thing. Carpenter's been strong throughout the year, and yeah, I agree with you that he has a much better chance of getting this award than getting the Rookie of the Year award. And, being the first person who isn't Earhart to get this feels like a really huge deal because, these guys, especially if you're talking Carpenter, but, none of these guys are extremely, old or over the hill or anything like that. It could feel almost like kind of a handing of the torch, see if they can do it this year and continue it next season. Are we seeing a future dominant LSM in the league?
That will be fun to track for sure. I think you really hit the nail on the head with your kind of recounting the Coach Brian Holman's take on Ethan Rahl. A lot of these stats won't show up, and that's the hard part of voting for All-Americans, like I mentioned, but also these end-of-season awards for when you get to the defensive positions, especially when we go over to the hard hat George Briarty, short stick defensive midfielder of the year. It's kind of why Danny Logan's been the default. Like, he's Revis Island, and guys don't want to dodge against him. He's joined by Ryan Tarafanko and a guy who somehow just mind-bogglingly so for me has just gotten like exponentially faster from year two to year three in his pro career, and Zach Geddes for the Chaos. A lot of stats don't show up for defenders. It's how well you play team defense, how well you stay on your man on ball, and how well can you stick to what your coaches are preaching. And we're not privy to a lot of that. The game plans that go into these Zoom meetings during the week in preparation. So I think that's kind of all that needs to be said for the D-Mitty group, unless you got any takes you want to unload. But I do want to get into the nitty-gritty of these next few major awards.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say about the Hard Hat Award is that none of these guys were nominated last year, which I find.
Danny Logan was?
No, it was an odd.
Oh, right, because the Atlas stunk. Oh, how quickly we forget.
Yeah, it was Latrell Harris, Zach Goodrich, and Bubba Fairman.
Well deserved, Latrell. We cannot wait to see Latrell Harris back, so.
Yeah, but it's tough to stick around on these things, right? Goodrich and Fairman, not there this year, kind of got bumped out for some other guys. But yeah, Logan is traditionally a mainstay up there and returns.
I do remember because there were some Logan was snubbed. He's just not. He doesn't have the numbers because, like I said, like guys do everything they can to avoid dodging against him, which in itself is, I think, a major recognition And let's go down to the Rookie of the Year finalist. There are five of them. I added five more for my slideshow if you want to check it out online. But here we will give you the league's announced finalist of TJ Malone, who we've mentioned, Brennan O'Neill, the first overall pick, Tyler Carpenter, the front runner in my eyes for the LSM of the year, Connor Schellenberger, second overall pick, and Liam Entman, who took over for Tim Trautner in week three. Rosie, I've gotten all my takes out of there.
Yeah, I think I'm certainly inclined to agree that the kind of the inside track for this one goes to esteemed friend of the pod, TJ Malone. Certainly not what a lot of people would have guessed at the start of this season. But, you know, it's no shade to some of these other people, right? Entman's had a fantastic year, a bit abbreviated, but still. And, you know, I think, you know, it might be different if we had seen Schellenberger a little bit more numbers-wise. But it's not different because, you know, we didn't. So what are you going to say? TJ Malone is going to continue the story of his remarkable season that starts with, you know, plummeting in the draft that, you know, he said he didn't really get caught up in. But who knows, maybe he's using that fuel and just keeping that to himself. But either way, he's doing pretty good so far. And I think it could result in a Rookie of the Year nod.
Yeah, a little bit of a hot and cold season when it comes to the first overall pick, Brennan O'Neill. There were two bagel games. That's games that he finished without a point. A couple games where, so he only had seven touches in the famous first game where he was held pointless in against Gavin Adler and the Atlas, where he was kind of brilliantly shut off for a lot of the game. 22 touches was the next lowest against the Whipsnakes and their regular season finale in Denver. And he ended up with a goal, I think his best goal of the year. And in that one with that sick one-hander at the end of the shot clock in that first quarter. But as we'll get to with the superlatives, he just had one of the best moments in that fourth quarter against the Archers. So shout out, Brennan. You came into a big role. And listen, I think no rookie dealt with more defensive game planning, more defensive pressure, and more, obviously, no rookie came in with more hype. So he's living up to it and excited to see how he carries it over to Boston for the first round. But Rosie, this is where I think we might differ. Coach of the Year. Give us your take. Give us the nominees first, the finalists.
Your nominees are Mike Pressler, Jim Stagnita, and Tim Sudan.
So Jim Stagnita has turned the season around from a 2-4 team into a 6-4 team, riding high on a 4-game win streak. Sort of a masterful offseason. I think he had the best draft. I said it on draft night, especially when you consider the post-draft pickups, who didn't really have too much of an impact this season. Remember, Adam Portress was picked in that fourth round. And second-round pick, Steven Zupetich, lost his role to Alex Mazzone, the mid-season pickup, who's fared quite nicely alongside Colin Squires at that LSM spot. Mike Pressler, he's in that kind of conversation with Tim Sudan and turning their team's fortunes around from a season ago, where Tim Sudan's Chrome is now the Outlaws, and they've gone from worst to mediocre would be mean, but 5-5 and in the playoff and in for a title hunt is definitely commendable. But Mike Pressler is just, I think, you come from a 2-8 team to now a 7-3 team. You see the moves he made in the offseason. Drafting Liam Entman 5th overall has really worked. Connor Schellenberger is the second quarterback that you really wanted. When healthy, it's worked just as well as you well could have hoped. And there's really, I don't think, too much to debate here unless you've got some stag stakes.
I mean, so, yeah, I did say this either last pod or two or three pods ago, just how, you know, the GM work that Staggs has done, you know, certainly not to make light of the outstanding GM work that Pressler did, you know, bringing over Tim Trautner as a bridge to bringing Entman in, and then, you know, the hope and assumption that Entman would pay off to the degree that he did. I mean, if you're going to use a pick that high on a goalie, you got to stick that landing. So, you know, certainly Pressler's done an outstanding job in the coaching and GMing department. Stagnita has also done a phenomenal GM job, I think. You know, making the moves he made. You know, we've seen him bring in Ryan Conrad, bring in Levi Anderson without giving up players. You know, picking up TJ Malone during the draft. He's kind of restructured that team and kind of, you know, made some difficult decisions along the way. You know, he wasn't scared to say let go of someone Will Manny's caliber and say we're going to set this up in a different direction. So yeah, I mean, he certainly gets a great deal of credit. Knowing he's not going to have Tucker Dordovic for a substantial part of the year and building around that, but then also when he gets him back, having to kind of rebound after almost immediately losing him again, just kind of shows that he has built a strong foundation again and then also reinforced the foundation. So I would not be surprised if Pressler wins it. I would also not be angry if Stagnita won.
Okay, I'm very happy that you didn't go this route, because I would have gone off on quite a rant where there's, you see the Whipsnake social, and it's like, and obviously I think the social's been great. You're rooting for your guys, but this is not a legacy award. The fact that Jim Stagnita has never won Coach of the Year, I don't think should play a role in him having even more of an advantage or more of a voting push this season. It's this season only. It's an annual award, and I'm glad you didn't go there, Rezzy. That's what I'll say.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's definitely all about this year. You know, it is, you know, if he hasn't won it before, then that's just a shame. You know, I don't care. That's not how we decide awards. That shouldn't be how you decide an award. And yeah, that's how, you know, subpar movies get awards sometimes, and subpar director things get awards.
Well, what it is, it's more, you know, of the timing of when these votes are due, right? It's the, if these awards were voted on after the postseason, then he would have two coaches of the year. So the fact that he's won two championships and kept the Whipsnakes a mainstay in the title race has been super impressive. And I kind of reject the notion that it is wrong to consider the Coach of the Year a de facto, like, turnaround team of the season. Mostly because I think what you do as a coach is about improving your team and bettering your squad from how bad they were last year. And like you said, there's no GM of the Year award. So there's, you got to lump it into both awards, lump the head coach and GM role as they have to deserve both. So, no, it'll be fun to see where they go with that. We're not going to touch on the sportsmanship or leadership or humanitarian or teammate. Although teammate, you're right in the rundown here. That is actually pretty interesting. Cole Kirst, Ryan Ambler, and Austin Kaut, all known for being tremendous teammates. Cole Kirst, the reigning winner as a rookie, and Ryan Ambler, your favorite pro's favorite pro, and Austin Kaut, just you can't say enough good things about just how he's handled being a backup in this league, and he's gotten his chance this year more than other seasons. You got any takes for where your head's at on this one?
You know, this is a really tough award to decide. You know, does Cole Kirst kind of relinquish his title? You know, was he a worse teammate this year? I would imagine no. But, you know, he wasn't as consistently in the lineup, so maybe that's going to matter to some people. I think maybe some people might lean towards Austin Kaut just because we saw him step up on the field on multiple occasions without a significant, like, drop-off. So, you know, I don't know what the voters are looking for particularly, but I feel like what he put out there in the games might give him the inside edge and take this award from Kirst this season. But, you know, I mean, Ambler ended the year as the captain for the Archers, so he's got that in his pocket as well.
Well said, well said. The Jim Brown Most Valuable Player of the Year Award. It's the moneymaker. I think it's one that's been decided since the halfway point of the season with Jeff Teat leading the way. Blaze Reardon, Tom Schreiber, the reigning MVP winner. Blaze being a, 21 MVP. And Asher Nolting in that mix as well. Rosie, again, I think it's like the attackman of the year. We probably could have lumped these two together. Who finished the second, right? Between Schreiber helping his squad win the West, where he couldn't finish the season, Blaze Reardon leading the best defense and anchoring them through injuries, and Asher Nolting, again, facilitating one of the most efficient offenses and kind of getting better as the season went on. It's going to be tough to beat Jeff Teat.
Yeah, I'm thinking if you were to place a bet on this, you would not get much money betting on Jeff Teat. I think the odds are pretty much stacked in his favor on this one. Even if we decided and agreed that we would not vote for him for some reason, I feel like our votes would not matter one bit. Second place, I don't know. I feel like maybe if we actually got to see them all ranked, which I don't think we will, I would guess Schreiber is going to get the second place.
Oh, really?
And Teat, obviously, first. Yeah, I just feel like, you know, as much as Blaze has brought from season to season, I feel like his absence being a bit more substantial than Schreiber's absence, just kind of, I think certain people, you kind of are inclined to, you know, give them a few votes based on what you've seen year to year. And I think Schreiber would probably have the inside track on that one.
Yeah, when it comes to second, I'll go Asher Nolting. I think the fact, like the Brian Holman pointed out earlier in the season where they were telling Asher, like, hey, stop going for the home run play. I think it was after three or four games in. You saw kind of his turnover numbers go up, and the Cannons offense wasn't quite as cohesive and clicking as well as they were last summer. And then ever since then, he's just been a man on a mission. No one's been able to guard him, and he's been throwing dimes left and right, throwing people open, throwing him exactly when they get open. So I'm going Asher Nolting second in my MVP ballot, if we were to order them. But Rosie, let's get to the meat of the show, 45 minutes in here, where additional superlatives, as we say. And I think this is where some of the spirited debate comes in. So listeners, if you fast forwarded to this point, then you are in luck, because let's go and first we'll give the listeners the categories that I've conjured up in the rundown. Best moment, best goal, best home crowd, and best game here. We're going to start out with best moment. And Rosie, I alluded to it in the MVP conversation. The fact that Jeff Teat tied the single season points mark, 44 points before the All-Star break, was my best moment of the season because of how ridiculous it was. The fact that it was a pass is one thing, because I think his threat to dodge and threat to score off the dribble was so much better this season. But the fact that it was a pass to Xander Dickson, being the best duo in the league, and Dickson scoring off a highlight reel BTV goal, that being the record tire. And then it's funny, we had all these graphics prepared where when they came back, and Edwards like, all right, he's probably going to break it in the first quarter. Atlas lay an egg, of course, after the All-Star break, and he only finishes with that transition goal from, I think, a crazy Cech Kamizio transition play. That's my best moment of the 2024 PLL regular season. Rosie, what are you going with?
Well, I'm going to go in a different direction entirely, because, to be honest with you, until you just mentioned it, I had forgotten what play he scored that point on. It was no longer in my brain. So I cannot, you know, in good faith, go with that one. I will go with the Ben O'Neal late game takeover against the hated Utah Archers. Rarely have we seen one moment from any one person that just kind of melted everybody's brains in attendance and in the viewing audience. I just think it was one of those sort of where were you kind of thing. You know, you're telling people, hey, check this out. Look at this nonsense he is doing. And he was just unstoppable for a sustained period of time. So, yeah, you know, afterwards, when you're like, have you ever seen anything like this ever? And, you know, even his coach, Tim Sudan, who has been around in one capacity or another for lacrosse as a player and coach for decades upon decades, was like, nope, I got no idea what that was. It's just, you know, that's the kind of moment that, you know, we might not get another one of those ever. Who knows? It was just ridiculous, the amount of points he put up, and everyone in the stadium knew it was going to him, and he was just unstoppable.
Yeah, and I think, to skip around from our rundown a little bit, I think that is in part of the conversation, maybe the front runner for most for game of the year. The fact that Ryan Boyle was so into it in that fourth quarter, get Brennan the ball the whole time. We need to see Brennan do this. And the crowd was behind him, being in North Carolina, where he played his college ball at Duke, a couple hours away at the game in Charlotte. So definitely has some good game of the year vibes to it, especially being an early season game, which was kind of surprising. But I'm going to go with the Matt Rambo overtime dagger game in Philadelphia, just the perfect ending to the Philadelphia homecoming for the Water, not from a Water Dogs perspective, of course, them dropping both their games in overtime, the Zach Tucci revenge game being the first among them. But this game had a lot of everything, back and forth game, Rambo the winner. For me, it was the game of the year, especially being an overtime. I do think it was kind of, not slim pickings, but kind of a tough choice with the game of the year selections, when we don't want to give O'Neal all of the superlatives with Utah versus Denver in that game. But Rosie, well, what are you going with?
I am going to go with, so the first two that you mentioned are both outstanding games. I'm going to toss into the nomination pool Archer's Chaos, Week 9 from Homewood Field. That was one of those games, very strong, back and forth. You know, you're never really sure who's going to take it. Both teams kind of traded punches. A 15-14 finish with Chaos taking the win. So, you know, it's not that you're not your typical Chaos ball from this season, you know, not your 8-7 kind of game. They just kind of went toe-to-toe with the defending champs. And, you know, if you've seen the kind of clips afterwards where Towers is basically saying, you know, you come into this atmosphere and everybody thinks you're going to lose, and you show it to them that, you know what you're doing. I don't remember exactly what he said, but I know it had a bunch of profanity in it. And it was accurate. You know, they were certainly underdogs heading into the game, and they just delivered. You know, Josh Byrne was huge. That's, of course, the game with Blaze Reardon. Kick it off with him going coast to coast. I mean, it pretty much had everything you could ask for in that kind of environment. Just constant, you know, Chaos jumped out to a huge lead, but Archers stuck through it, kind of fought their way back, and essentially just traded punches the entire second half. Like literally, it was just one team scores, then another team scores, and then they couldn't string together runs because it was just kind of like that boxing movie where you're just trading haymakers until somebody falls.
Right. The fact that you're on the sideline too, did that play a role in kind of how much you enjoyed it?
Probably. I would say that probably helped a little bit. Being fortunate enough to be there on the sideline, I will say I don't believe I've ever seen a goalie goal at ground level. That felt very much, you know, everybody in the whole place, you know, on the sidelines and then the stands, the roar that happens, you know, basically step by step once Blaze gets close to midfield is something that's really difficult to replicate in any other environment. Just everyone constantly kind of just willing him to keep running. And they're like, keep going. Oh, he's going to do it. Holy crap, he's going. And the roar just keeps going with every step he takes. Yeah, I mean, that them being there for it is probably helps a little bit. And then, you know, having that one particular play also kind of bumps it up a notch.
Yeah. For me, I think that's for all those reasons why I'm going with Blaze Reardon's goalie goal as my goal of the season for the regular season. Of course, the crowd. And I think Kark's reaction rivaled Boyle's O'Neill takeover in that fourth quarter earlier in the season. Just from, like you said, everyone was like, all right, step by step, he's getting closer to the net. They're not sliding. Oh, Blaze did it. It was incredible. And the fact that, to give a little more context, the day before was just two awful blowouts. And that being the opener for day two, and opening the opener in that manner just was just what that crowd needed, and it was pretty awesome. So I'm going with that for my goal of the season.
Yeah, I would say, as far as I'm concerned, like context wise, I definitely agree that was the goal of the season. Kicking off a game against anyone, let alone the defending champs, but kicking off a game with a goalie goal is just the most kind of, you know, just the nuttiest way to get your team revved up that you can possibly imagine. Like how could they possibly think they're going to lose that game if the first goal is scored by their goalie? But in a vacuum, I'd say, with only the goal itself being considered, I think the goal of the year was Connor Fields going between the legs on that top corner. Nonsense, I think, is the best way to describe it. You know, with an all-world defenseman, Matt Dunn, playing excellent coverage. Just the audacity to even try that in an organized sporting event just makes no sense. And putting it with that kind of accuracy, just ridiculous. ridiculous, just ridiculous all around. I mean, he's still narrating the clip, right? Week 11, they had him on SportsCenter and they were like, yeah, you know, congrats on the win and stuff. But seriously, talk us through that goal from weeks and weeks ago, because I got to know why you did that.
Yeah, he was like his matchup just shading him down that righty alley the whole game. You can tell Fields was like, all right, I got to figure out some way to get off some type of release. And lo and behold, I've been practicing that shot on my mini goal in the aisle office ever since and have yet to replicate it. So that is quite incredible feat to do, considering the net is 6 feet tall and not the 3x net that we have in said office. Now, Rosie, we've gone almost an hour here, but the crux of the playoff push is here, and Gillette Stadium, make sure you tune in for the quarterfinals on Labor Day Monday. So you're off school, you're off work obligations, get the burgers flipping. 4 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. ESPN2 to start, and then ESPN Plus. Rosie, let's start with the first game here. Carolina Chaos versus the Boston Cannons. Now, it's cool that both games here for three of the four teams, that is, have finished their season against one another. That's the Maryland Whipsnakes played the Outlaws in their regular season finale. Of course, the Outlaws still had a game or two to go. And just last week, or 2 weeks ago, excuse me, the Chaos and Cannons faced off. And Ryan Drenner found the OT winner. Rosie, we'll have more in-depth analysis written-wise coming your way for you listeners. But you made it this far in the episode. We've got some more to say about these matchups. The fact that, so I've rewatched both these games and both these matchups. The amount of posts that the Cannons hit in this game was just insane. Like 10 total, I think. It felt like 20. Aslanian, it felt like, hit 5 himself. And Kavanaugh felt like he hit 15. There's a lot of matchups I think are going to be really interesting in this one. I think the Newman-Nolting Goliath versus Goliath is chief among them. And then you go to the other side of the field where I think Garrett Eppel and company are trying to contain Josh Byrne and all those two-man games. So much so to the fact that there was one play where I forget who was guarding him, but Kyle Jackson was about to set up that two-man game famously on that lefty wing. And his matchup's like, you are not taught to have this stance in youth ball, for sure, at any level, really. But he was showing him the middle of the field. He's like, you are not going towards Josh Byrne to get me out of that talent. I am not getting switched on to Fern again. I think it was one of the Cannons D middies. Anyway, and it ends up with Kyle Jackson taking a wild shot that missed with three guys sliding to him and everyone draped over him. But it just shows you the amount of respect they have for Byrne and that two-man game that obviously Chaos haven't used as much with their new offensive pieces. But, Rose, what are some things that you're looking for in this one?
Well, I think the biggest mystery, aside from, so like the quickest one you can get out of the way right now is who's facing off for Chaos, right? That's the big question number one. Nick Rowlett is on the injury report. We didn't see him last time. Questionable with right knee pain. Now, I have to imagine when it comes to the postseason, most questionables will kind of be, you know, nudge towards like, hey, can you do it? If you're good to go, you know, now's the time to go. But the question is, are they really going to push him back into action at this point, or just let him rest, you know? Because his replacement, James Riley, went 12 for 24 last against this same team. So I don't know how desperately they try to get Rowlett back into action or not. That being said, I think another question, another mystery that we're waiting to have unveiled is how Boston is going to handle that attack line. We touched on this a little bit last time. The last time these two faced one another, they were really juggling that third attack spot. You know, obviously, Nolting and Holman were locked in there at one and two. But that third spot was up in the air, right? You know, Pat Cavanaugh and Matt Campbell were kind of switching between attack and midfield. So, you know, we've seen some bright moments from Pat Cavanaugh. We haven't really seen a dominant game or an error-free game from him at that position. So do they want to keep him back in that spot with obviously more on the line this time around? Do we see his brother return to the lineup? You know, on one hand, we have not seen him in a while. So there would be the question of, you know, how are your legs? Are you good to go? Maybe the rest has helped him. And we do know he has a tremendous postseason resume, for what it's worth. And I don't know how much Brian Holman would really factor in anything other than what have you done lately, as far as that goes. I mean, but we did see him, you know, it's kind of his thing, right? It's what he's known for. You don't know if he's got another one in the tank, but that is what he's known for, thriving in the big pressure moments. Do we see him back in? And if that was the case, maybe they should have brought it back in sooner. I don't know what they do with that spot, but I think it's going to make a significant difference in trying to get more of an offense than they had the last time these two played, and they put up 11 goals total. Granted, like you said, the pipe played a huge role. You know, there could have been easily a few more that snuck in there with a little bit, you know, a little bit of luck one way or another. But that third attack spot is a huge question mark.
Now, we got my take last podcast on it. I mentioned that Matt Campbell, I think, is I like the move because Matt Campbell is a great shooter in transition, and having a natural lefty in transition, I think, is always the smarter thing to do. Although you did see Cavanaugh bury that lefty goal in transition early in the season. It's not that he's a liability or anything. I just think Campbell's sharp shooting is too good to pass up. I do understand the flip side that you want Cavanaugh on the field the whole game because he's just that good. He's the reigning Thornton winner. Matt Campbell, I do think, is a better downhill dodger. And I think it's kind of a same situation with the Archers, going with Matt Moore, going with Trey LeClaire over Grant Ament, who's been coming out of the box, now nominated for Midfielder of the Year. So I like Matt Campbell as a 32-second shot clock attackman over Pat Cavanaugh. You mentioned the role it'll play in this game, but let's pin you down. And where are you on the Cavanaugh versus Campbell debate?
I think they're going to move Campbell back to midfield, particularly to kind of stretch out the attack a bit more, keep the threat of the two-point shot a little more active. Then they would sacrifice keeping him, you know, obviously you can move around a great deal, right, during a game. But I think when he's coming in out of the box, he can kind of stretch out that defense a little bit more. And, you know, maybe they can worry about, you know, somebody like, say, a Geddes or a Ray or whoever they're going to assign to cover him this time around. You know, trying to keep him a little bit more honest and keep him a little more focused on connecting to Campbell and hopefully prevent him from breaking out a little bit earlier. So I think we're going to see him in more of a return to a traditional role. But I certainly think he has, you know, validity in what you're saying as the attackman. But I was suspicious
right.
of of the Cannons when they did it last time. And I thought maybe they were just kind of shaking things up to shake things up, knowing that this was a potential playoff matchup. And they didn't really have anything to lose in that regard. So we'll see. But yeah, I think Campbell goes back and maybe tries to, you know, drop some bombs.
But you definitely wouldn't put like Matt Kavanaugh or Will Manny into the lineup.
I think it's too late to put Manny in. If they wanted to have him in, I would not throw him out at this point and just kind of, you know, I mean, granted they could have worked with him during practice and things of that nature, but I don't think it's necessarily something they want in their offense anyway. You know, I think they signed Will Manny, you know, because he's a competent attackman and also largely because he's Will Manny, right? But I don't think it was designed with, you know, okay, he'll be the fourth option on attack for us. I think their third attackman will have the last name Kavanaugh.
But will not decide if Matt will be back in the lineup. Very diplomatic answer. I love it. Whipsnakes versus the Outlaws are the second matchup that we're looking forward to on Labor Day Monday here. Now, Whipsnakes kind of put a beating on them. 16-9, the final score, felt like a little bit of a larger margin. But, yeah, TJ Malone, just a masterclass. You think he put up a balanced stat line in that one. And you saw Zed Williams get his. Matt Rambo had a couple. And just balanced offense all around. And those matchups, it's kind of hard. Like JT Giles Harris went on Zed, and Mike Manley was on Rambo to kind of match those physicality. And Greg Weil is left in as this fill-in replacement, having to guard the likely rookie of the year and TJ Malone. So he feasted with making all the right decisions at the right times. Ryan Conrad makes his debut and has his best game of the season, rejuvenated. But Rosie, Malone said it, we'll see how it works out. But this is their first game in 24 days. Getting the bye week, then the league bye. They definitely earned their bye week with a 4-game win streak. That is for sure. They earned the extra rest. Right. And if anyone's getting better with recovering from any kind of ailments or injuries, then credit to you. But I think this will play into Denver's advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. This really, I think, plays into Denver's advantage. First of all, Weil is apparently back. He's not on the injury report anymore. You know, we saw him go down with some sort of shoulder ailment, similar to what happened to Bernhardt. So if they get him back in the lineup, that's, you know, something that can definitely help them out. I also think time is a huge advantage because, you know, they kind of got popped in the face with Ryan Conrad's role in the Maryland offense. And, you know, they didn't really have anything on tape from earlier in the season. You know, you couldn't watch any Water Dogs games and know that that's how Ryan Conrad was going to play. Just because, you know, he was a different part of the Maryland offense than he was the Philadelphia offense. So they looked unprepared to cover someone who was going to, you know, initiate in that direction, who was going to, you know, really feast on inverts against short sticks and that kind of thing that he really thrived on. You know, Conrad was just moving all around the field and, you know, really, really making things difficult if you're not prepared for that sort of thing. Now they've had a much longer time to get ready for it. So will they be able to, you know, effectively extinguish any of these attacks from Ryan Conrad? I'm not going to say that, but time and preparation is certainly going to work in their favor as far as they can, you know, get their slides a little bit better. Now they understand that what they saw is a possibility of experiencing again. So I'm not saying this takes them all the way from that game we previously saw to making them a favorite this time, because that's a mighty big swing. but I do think that they should definitely be able to approach what they're going to see a bit differently.
Now, the second lowest total in terms of touches, as we mentioned earlier in the pod, for Brendan O'Neill in this one, 22 touches. He only had 10 around the halfway through the third quarter, so ramped up. So we've been saying it all season. Everyone's been saying it. You got to get Brennan going early. Brendan O'Neill needs to get going early, and that's easier said from us two than it is done on the field. But Rosie, I posit to you this. Is it more important for O'Neill to get going in that first quarter, or more important for Sam Hanley, Graham Bundy, Dalton Young, and others to win their matchups against what has to be one of the weaker short stick defensive midfield groups in the league?
I absolutely like where your head's at, and I wholeheartedly agree. If they can get scoring elsewhere, then they can write off the matchup between O'Neill and Dunn. You know, if it's going to come down to Brendan O'Neill getting, you know, 35 touches and producing, they picked a really bad weekend for that to be their strategy, right? You know, I mean, Matt Dunn has shown that he can solidly handle that matchup. You know, it might be a bit different this time around, but I'm not really sure if the answer is keep trying to go after Matt Dunn over and over again. You know, yeah, if you have the opportunity to kind of try to attack that short stick defensive midfield unit from Maryland, that's probably where you're going to want to try to do it. You know, we've seen Ajax have his matchups handled. It doesn't really seem like the, you know, that's not the weakness in the fence, right? If they can get something going with the guys up top, that seems to be where they should really focus on doing it. You know, certainly not taking O'Neill out of the game or Law out of the game. You still want them to get enough touches to keep everyone spread, to force the slides and everything of that nature. But if you can get someone like, you know, your Graham Bundy hitting, you know, some deep shots, spreading everything around, you know, pop a two-pointer or something to kind of keep things moving, I think they'll have much better luck overall than kind of, you know, hitching their wagon to O'Neill on this one and hoping he can get a liver the whole way.
Which game do you think is a bigger toss-up?
I feel like Cannon's Chaos is a bigger toss-up based on, you know, what we most recently saw. You know, I don't expect either game to be exactly like what we just saw when the teams most recently played each other. You know, I feel like there's certainly a chance Denver can reload with a little bit better approach this time around. But you never know with this Chaos team, and not to dwell on stuff that is a little too, you know, up in the air and not really a solid thing, right? But it is playoff chaos. Now, is this playoff chaos the same as the Dane Smith era playoff chaos? I don't know. I don't know what it is about it that has made them so successful, but they have been very successful through the years of finding ways to kind of, you know, adapt and weasel their way through the regular season and then turn up when they need it the most. So I would certainly say, I mean, this is not a game for Boston to go in asleep on, even though they're facing a team that has traditionally not had much of an offense.
They love being the sixth seed. They love being the seventh seed. They love being the last seed in the PLL playoffs. You nailed it. So last year was really, what, the first year they were knocked out in the first round? Maybe the second with Connor Fields' 2019 team. All right, I'm going to hold you to this. We're going to go through the playoff bracket. We're going to make our playoff predictions right here, right now. Starting with Cannon's Chaos, the winner gets the honor and privilege of playing the top-seeded New York Atlas on Long Island. Who's coming away with this one, Cannon's or Chaos?
I am going Cannons.
You're going Cannons. I am also going Cannons. It's very tough for me.
I feel like that means Chaos is going to win.
Like, with the historical record Chaos have, and I do think, like, there's almost a recipe of the Cannons laying another egg this postseason. But it being at Gillette, them being in a Boston team now, I think they've grown from last year's experience, and I'm sticking with the Cannons with you. I'm going Boston. Whipsnakes, Outlaws, winner gets to play the Archers.
I think the Whipsnakes have just been so strong lately that I don't see it stopping right now, even though they've had all of this time off to possibly cool down. I just think they're too strong right now. So I am going Maryland Whipsnakes.
Too strong, known for their defense and special teams. Now they have an offense. So it's hard to disagree with you, but I will. 24 days off, too many. Outlaws take this one and get Brendan O'Neill more involved early. And sets up quite the rematch of that game of the season contender, Utah versus Denver in the semifinals. Let's start with this one. Who are you taking to advance to Philly?
Utah, oh, no. Well, you have Denver.
Sorry, I have Utah, Denver. You have Utah versus Maryland.
I think, oh man, this is really, really, really tough. I am going to say, because, you know, I really like a good goalie in the postseason, so I'm inclined to go with Dobson. But with Schreiber being out, I think it might not be in the cards for them. So I am taking
the Whipsnakes all the way to the final. I am going to have to disagree with you. I think the Archers have what it takes. I also don't have the Whipsnakes advancing, so this is going to be over the Outlaws. And I think the Outlaws, if you look at their season, it's been win-loss, 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 win-loss. 5-5, 500. They haven't won two in a row. I don't think that starts in the postseason. So I'm going with the Archers getting a chance to defend their title, getting back into the title game. All right, so we both have the Atlas Cannons, which the two powers in the Eastern Conference all season long. Who is going to the championship?
Oh, man. I feel like Atlas hasn't played in about 2 months. This is a difficult one. I think they split the season series, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see here. I really like a strong face-off performance from Baptiste, which I think pushes it Atlas way. Let's see. Podcast bump for Adler. carry the four. Man, this is a really tough one.
Seems like you're going one way.
Yeah, the math is apparently mathing towards New York. I hadn't really thought about this one. Man, championship series win bump for the Cannons. Man, I don't know. Yeah, maybe this is New York's year. But on the other hand, I don't like how they've been finishing the season.
Yeah, you've been on that.
Jeez. Yeah, they have not been impressing me throughout the latter portions of this season. But do I think the Cannons have what it takes to just steamroll everybody? I will go with... in New York, too. I got to factor that in. Oh, man. It is a home game, kind of.
Like the home game for the Long Islanders / Albanyers.
That's true. Man, I guess I'm going Atlas. I am as surprised as anyone else. I did not know when I started thinking where I would go with that. I guess I'm taking Atlas. Oh, man,
that was a roller coaster. I am also going Atlas. I think these are the best two teams the PLL has to offer, despite some turbulence in the archery season. I do really want to see the rematch of the Atlas versus Archers game that we saw towards the end of the season, I think back in week 9. I'm really excited. I think Atlas pulled out. I could see that. I don't think they've ever advanced to the title game. So laying an egg in the semis, very possible. I don't think it'll happen. I think Connor Schellenberger will benefit more than anyone from the time off. And having both Shelly and Teat takes them over the edge. First time champs, Atlas get it done over the reigning champs and Schreiber-less Archers.
Yep. I think, thinking about last year's championship, when you saw what Schreiber did, right? You know, he just brought the magic, right? Not just the ability, not just the talent, but the sort of clutch magic. And, it's just this Atlas team has a lot of superstars on it who would really kind of take a leap here. Like you mentioned, not being at this stage yet. But, you know, you're never there until you get there, right? So, you know, somebody like Jeff Teat kind of puts a bow on this entire season and grabs himself his first professional championship in any format, which really just seems like a matter of time, you know, if you're producing the way he does. Maybe this could be the year.
I've convinced you just like that. I love it. It's man, Kevin and Rosie both going for the Atlas. New York, do not let us down. I know Boston will not at Gillette Stadium. Listeners, thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard, let us know. Leave a review, tell a friend, pass it on, and have fun watching these games on Labor Day Monday.